feel like I've talked a lot already, which is usually the case, right, for me. Well, listen, we have just come out of a series that we called Welcome Home, where we talked about what it meant to live in the kingdom of heaven, where we focused in on what it meant to be a disciple of Jesus and what it looked like to live the life of a disciple here and now. And we zoomed in on a couple of components there. We're gonna continue to develop those a little bit more in this next season that we have together. Those particular components that we're gonna deep dive into are what it means to know and love God and what it means to know and love ourselves. So in this next several weeks that we're gonna be together here in the summertime, we're gonna be jumping into this series that we're calling Inside Out. If you notice here, the graphics behind me, purposefully chosen to give us that 90s feel. And as this series kind of rolls along, you'll see why. But we're actually going to be talking about what it looks like to be a real person living a real life with a real God. And that's what we're going to do for this next season. We're going to do that particularly looking in the book of Psalms here for the next several weeks. But before we jump in, I want to show you some real footage of our intern, Hannah, at home, interacting with her parents around mealtime. And you're going to see a little bit about what goes on inside of her head in real time. So if you can go ahead and play that clip. Thanks. There she is. Give Hannah and her parents a hand in releasing that footage. Thank you very much. Of course, that was from the movie Inside Out, which explores what it's like to have emotions and to be a real human being. And so it gives you a little bit of flavor for where we're going to be digging around for the next several weeks. As I mentioned earlier, we're going to be looking through the Psalms. And here's what we know about the Psalms. The Psalms are really a book of mostly poems and poetry that are used in several different ways. So here's some general background on the Psalms, as we know. One, I mentioned poetry. Poetry in the Hebrew culture of the day was a pretty recognized and well-used form of communication, poetry was. Poetry is also this natural way, like it is now, to express the deepest feelings and insights, prayer, praise, wisdom, lament, etc. Poetry. We all know about poetry, don't we? For example, I made this one up this morning. Yet soft, what light through yonder window breaks? It is the east, and Juliet is the sun. Arise, fair sun, and kill the envious moon, which is already sick and pale with grief, for thou art a maiden more fair than she. Right? You like that? Give me a hand. I made that up this morning. It was from my friend Bill that made that up a little while ago, but he said I could use it today. Poetry, it's powerful language, right? And if we're honest, it's really effective at helping us explore what's going on inside of us and getting what's going on inside of us out. Hannah, I'd like for you to come. Why don't you just stand there, actually, and it's magic. Try it.
Is it working?
Okay, all right, so here we go. We're going to show you just how easy it is to express the emotions that are going on inside of us. Now, Hannah, I'd like to say we didn't practice this, but I did mention we were going to do this morning, and we kind of got an idea of what we were going to do so we didn't embarrass ourselves too much, right?
Too late.
too late, she said. So we're going to write a poem right now, right in front of you all, to show you how effective poetic language can be. Ready? I'm going to start a line of a piece of poetry, and she's going to end the line, and we're going to do that until we've completed everything and exhausted everything that's going on inside of our hearts. Ready? Roses are...
violet.
And violets are...
red.
Your pastor is...
crazy.
And so are...
everybody else.
Okay. All right. The grammar wasn't that great there. But you see how we like to use poetry and also have our intern be involved in funny stuff that gets her used to being in front of people. So poetry, this common language of the people of Israel, the Hebrew writers, they used a lot of poetry, and it is really present in the book of Psalms. So we also know beyond prayer, praise, wisdom, lament, and etc., because we're also going to be encountering some vengeance and anger and bitterness also in this poetic language, which is super rad when you're trying to explore what real people have going on inside themselves when they're living real life with a real God. And finally, we know that a lot of the Psalms were set to music. We don't have a record of what the tunes were. We may make a stab at some of them. John Schultz is going to be participating later in this month, and he said he pretty much knows, he remembers when these psalms were written and sung, and he might produce some of the original music for that. Thanks, brother. So listen, the psalms, he's leaving. These psalms are these really expressive works of art that are born out of what's going on inside of these humans. We know that they're written by several different people. Those are the ones we know of. We're pretty sure we have no idea what a vast number of them, who they were written by. But the point is to know that these are real people writing these things as an expression of what's going on inside of them. A way to think about this poetry, kind of like the way we think about it now, but the way that we can think about the Psalms is that these are written expressions of the responses of real people's hearts to God's revelation to them in real time. Like they're in moments, they're in circumstances, they're undergoing something. And God is revealing himself in the midst of that. And so what we have as a written record passed down to us today are their responses. Sometimes I like to think about them like journal entries, but they're even cooler than journal entries, right? Because they were set to music, and people have read them and repeated them and utilized other people's words like this to help describe what they're feeling all these centuries later. And so that's what we're going to dip into here. This is a response to God's revelation emerging from real life, real pain, real joy, real anger, real brokenness, etc. So today, we're going to look at a real tame psalm, right? Because we're just starting off. We don't want to scare you away. So we're going to look at Psalm 3. Right at the beginning of this collection of collections, as Psalms is regularly referred to by the people that study the literature involved, a collection of poetry. So Psalm 3 is a psalm that we're pretty sure was written by King David about a really, really, really specific context going on in his life. So for the background of this, We can look in 2 Samuel. We're not going to look in there today. But here's the story of what's going on in King David's life around the time that he is reflecting what's going on inside of him in this psalm. So King David had lots of kids. And one of his kids, his daughter Tamar, was violated. She was sexually assaulted by her half-brother, and it was a pretty brutal ordeal. Now, that assault was reported to the king and to the rest of the family, and for some reason, we don't know what, really nothing came of it, no justice was had, and that really ticked off one of Tamar's brothers. His name was Absalom. So what do we know about this guy is that he was super handsome. That's one of the details that the scriptures give us. But also, he was pretty dead set on making things right for his sister. And so what we can also see from the biblical record, the story that's passed down to us there in 2 Samuel, is that he plotted and he schemed to get his brother alone, and Absalom and several of his other brothers took care of the offending brother, meaning muerte, done. They murdered him in order to have justice for their sister. So, you know, not a small event. Took place over some time. There was premeditation. There was a lot of creativity actually utilized in bringing about the end of Amnon, the offending brother. So right there, if you were David, and these are your kids, what's going on in your head and in your heart? Just put yourself in his shoes for a moment. What are you feeling? What are you thinking? Real people having real emotions. Guilt? Feeling guilty? Maybe that you didn't step in? What else? What else would you feel? Turmoil? Yeah, for sure. Grief? Some loss? What's that? Despair is a great word. What else?
Anger.
Helplessness. All this stuff is happening away from him. Right? He doesn't have control over the response of the people in his world to this tragedy. So here's what goes on. Absalom, after he makes all this stuff happen, he takes off. He runs away, but he doesn't stay away, and eventually he comes back home. And when he comes back home, he still is super angry, even though the object of his wrath had been taken care of, so to speak. He comes back, though, and even killing his brother Amnon didn't resolve his anger and his pain. Real human being in a real life situation, right? Experiencing what humans experience when things like this happen. So he comes back, and he begins to plot against the demise of his father, David, the king. And he's really sneaky about it, and it takes a few years, I think 4 years, as he's implementing this plan. Can you imagine this? His son Absalom is hatching a plot to overthrow King David for over 4 years, and he implements it and executes it perfectly. And then one day, King David's servants come in and say, "We got to get out of here, because the whole country, the whole nation is now aligned with Absalom, and he's pretty ticked, and he's pretty bent on getting rid of you." And so if we were to read further in that story, we know that David gets up and he takes off, and he takes off with those who are loyal to him, and they have this procession, and they get up and they leave the city, Jerusalem, they leave the holy city, right? And as we look into that story, we see some details about how they walked out of there, and there was not a dry eye. They were not defiant. They were not like, "We will overcome." They were weeping, their heads bowed. King David, in particular, he's described as walking with his head bowed in shame and just weeping great tears. This is the context of this psalm. Psalm 3. So we can bring up those, there we go. So this psalm, this poetry that expresses what's going on in this human's heart based on what he's experiencing, and we'll see as we read through it also the revelation of God to him in this moment. So here's how it works. Lord, how many are my foes? How many rise up against me? Many are saying of me, God will not deliver him. And we're going to pause there for a second because for two reasons. One, in the English version, this doesn't seem a lot like poetry, but it is. And two, as we kind of dip into this, it's important for you to know the meaning behind the words that he chose to use to express himself. So as we get in here, he says, Lord, how many are my foes? He's expressing despair, maybe. He's expressing maybe some fear, some frustration. I mean, this is King David, right? How many are my foes? It's like the whole nation has turned against him because it has. Can you imagine that? If you put yourself in his place, can you imagine what he's feeling? How many are my foes, he says. How many rise up against me? And this language, rise up against me, is language that is kind of military language for the people of Israel, because there was this practice. When they would be called to war, the Ark of the Covenant, this box that held some important cultural artifacts, but also was kind of recognized as where the presence of the Lord was physically while they were kind of meandering around the nation of Israel before they were permanent, and there was a temple, there was the Ark, right? And when they would go out to battle, when they would go out to war, they would say, we will not go out until the Lord rises up and goes out. We will not go to war until the Lord rises up and goes out. So David is using this language of his own like mighty military conquest, you know, because he kind of authored a lot of these battles and a lot of these victories. And so he's like, how many are my foes? And God, they rise up and they come at me in battle. It's like the whole nation is coming after me, which again is kind of like what was happening there. Everyone is militarized and mobilized for my defeat, for my undoing. Put yourself in his shoes. He's pouring this out to God right in the opening lines of this psalm. Many are saying of me, God will not deliver him. This is David. This is David. That when he was just a little shepherd, went to bring cheese and bread and provisions to his brothers as the armies of Israel were being attacked and overwhelmed by the Philistines. And the Philistine champion Goliath calls out for a champion of Israel day after day after day, and no one is confident enough, no one is bold enough. The men of Israel will not go and face him. And this shepherd boy says, my God, my God has said he would give us the victory. My God said he will deliver us. Let me go. This is the man now become king, writing this psalm. And what an insult, what an offense for that man who in front of the whole nation as a young teen said, our God is big enough to handle everything, to rescue us from every foe, and I will go. And then he says, how many of them are saying that my God has deserted me and will not be the God that I know him to be? This is like deep soul wrenching muck that David is expressing. But then his attention shifts. And this is where we begin to see and feel this pattern in this poetry of how God reveals himself in the midst of things, in the midst of real life circumstances. The attention shifts to the next line of the poem. But you, Lord, are a shield around me. You are my glory, the one who lifts my head high. I call out to the Lord and he answers me from his holy mountain. There's a lot here. The shield around me, like literally around me. I'm completely protected. Not from my armies, not by my reputation, not by my status as king, but by you, Lord. So even in the midst of him confessing that he's in pain, that he's in despair, that he's on the run for his life, he says, but you're God. Even though they say he's not going to rescue you this time, David says, but you're God. You protect me on all sides, not just physically, but as a human being, I'm shielded by you. The one who lifts my head high, and it calls us to that part of the story that I related to you where scriptures actually tell us that as he's leaving the city, his head is bowed in shame and with the weight of this context and he's weeping. Lord lifts his head high, right? Puts his shoulders back, reminds him of who he is. This is God revealing himself in the midst of this very real life situation. I call out to the Lord and he answers me from his holy mountain, the holy mountain where God's presence is, where they worshiped him, where when kings were coronated, they were coronated on the holy mountain, right? Is this place of supreme authority and power that God comes from. And David is saying in the midst of this, as God has revealed himself to him, the place where all authority is, the place where all power comes from, the place as the center of our relationship with you, you answer me from there. You come and deliver me from there. And as we're talking about this shift in attention, we have to make a note of something else that's very real in the Psalms. It's actually a really powerful dynamic that for me is one of the most important reasons to read the Psalms. Because we can read them and be depressed. We can read them and be comforted. We can read them and become filled with joy and praise depending on what's going on. But there's a central piece that's a part of every psalm, and that's the relationship that every writer of the Psalms has with God. This capacity for David's attention to be turned from the very real, very crazy, deep, dark context that he's in is because he has a covenant relationship with the King of the universe. David has, all the other psalmists have, a relationship with God that's described as a covenantal relationship, this relationship where God promises to come after us day after day after day, to rescue us day after day after day. And even if our bones be ground to dust, which is language we can find in the Psalms, we would still say, but God, I'm yours and you're mine. There's a substance in this relationship that every writer of the Psalms has that enables them to turn from despair to hope. And I really want us to be impressed by that. I really want it to settle in that had they not had this relationship, they probably couldn't have turned their attention. They probably couldn't write what we are seeing them writing, this revelation from God being expressed alongside of the despair and the depression and the pain and the fear. For example, I mentioned this Hebrew understanding of war. They would say that, God would rise up and go out and there was no victory to be had unless God fought on their behalf. Unless God fought in and through them. So David is expressing this shift of his perspective, taking his eyes off the really, really bad scenario that he's found himself in and placing them in the King of the Covenant, in the one that possesses all of the authority and all of the power. And he says, look, my God, the one who answers me, I know you're going to answer me. They say you're not going to answer me. I know that you will answer me. And David has a lot of street cred in this because God has answered him time and time again. Let's go on to this next section. I lie down and sleep. I wake again because the Lord sustains me. I will not fear, though tens of thousands assail me on every side. How many of you have life situations that you have been in or that you are in that prevent you from resting? How many of you, when you lay down, the lights are off, the TV is off, the kids aren't talking, your spouse isn't talking, whomever is in your world at the time is, there's no other noise but what's ticking in your own head, that conversation that comes about. You know what David's going through then. And in the midst of this real life situation, David says, because you are the God that I know you to be, I'm going to lay down and sleep. I lie down and sleep. I wake again because the Lord sustains me. I will not fear, though tens of thousands assail me on every side. He's not imagining himself in a place that isn't real, right? He's acknowledging that tens of thousands of foes assail him on every side, but just two lines before this, he said, God, you surround me. You surround me. You are my shield on every side. It doesn't matter how many foes come from any direction. You are my God. And I can lay down and shut my mind off and shut my fear off and shut my despair off. And I can just be sustained by you. So there's this poetry that we just read through, and it leads us up to this next line, which actually now is in a form of prayer, and this language should sound familiar to you. Arise, Lord. It's that military kind of call, right? Get up, God. And go out ahead of me. For there is no victory that can be had apart from you winning it, either in or through me. Arise, Lord, deliver me, my God. And then here's some language that we might not, you know, think was ever in Scripture. Strike all my enemies in the jaw. Break the teeth of the wicked. How many of you have prayed that prayer? John Schultz, just a few moments ago, thank you, after I made mention to his intimate awareness of the writing of these Psalms. Strike all my enemies on the jaw and break the teeth of the wicked, a real person, having real emotions in the midst of a real life circumstance that is also rooted in this covenant relationship with a covenant God, a real God that's present. And he still, smack him around. Right? Much like it is still in our culture today, if you would walk up then and smack someone in the face, especially a man open-handed smacking another man in the face, what would you consider that to be if that happened in front of you or happened to you? What would you feel? It's go time. What else? Why is it go time? It's super insulting. No man slaps me, says Mr. Hill. It's offensive. So David, a real man in a real life situation, has this real stuff pouring out of him before his God, and in a form of a prayer, no less, he said, would you just reduce them by insulting them and offending them on my behalf? This isn't the only place or in the only psalm that we're going to come in contact with this kind of language or this kind of thought going on inside someone's life. Smack them around. Bust out their teeth. Bust out their teeth. Which could be bust out their teeth, right? They've pursued me. They've offended me. God, would you just beat up the bully for me? Do unto them what they have done unto me. Right? The reverse golden rule. There's that in there, but also remembering that what they had said about him, God's never going to come and deliver you. God will not answer you. God is not present. God does not show you favor. God does not love you. He is not going to keep up his end of the covenant. Well, is it possible for someone to pronounce that with their teeth busted out? And so there's a sense also here that David may also be saying, God, would you just shut him up? Because I know who you are. I know what our relationship means to you and to me. And I'm quite confident, as we see in the next line, the last line of the psalm, from the Lord comes deliverance. At the beginning, they said, he's not going to deliver you. But David works his way through his pain. He works his way through some of the stuff that's going on in his heart based on how God has revealed himself to him. And he says at the end, of course, you will deliver us. Of course, you will deliver me. Not my armies, not my sons, you, Lord. May your blessing be on your people. This is a little bit of poetry. We didn't get into the form of why it's poetry in the original language, but it's there, trust me. That lent itself then to this very real prayer. So there's a couple of takeaways we want you to have with you as you leave this place today and come back next week to keep on this journey of exploring what it looks like to follow God, to know him and love him, to know ourselves more deeply, which includes admitting we have emotions, which includes admitting that there are things going on inside of us that need to be addressed because of what we're experiencing. We want you to see that real people have real life situations where real things are going on inside of them, and we can be real with God. This idea of being honest with God is at the foundation of the poetry in the Psalms. And if you're like me, you've heard people say, and you have maybe even said it yourself, I shouldn't think that way. I shouldn't say that. Well, as you'll see over the next few weeks, none of the writers of the Psalms ever had a hesitation about what they were writing. It was just them and the God that was revealing himself to them in the midst of their real life situations. And this is where they're writing from, this covenant relationship, which is so vital to be able to take our eyes off of the stuff going on and see what it is that's actually happening, that God is working out in our lives something other than the despair and the frustration and the fear that's in front of us. So here are the takeaways. The words of every psalm have real life circumstances and a real person behind them. Every single one, even if we can't pinpoint who exactly it is writing the particular psalm that we're looking at, when you're reading them, start from the place that this is a real person that has a real life that's experiencing real things. Second, the responses of the writers in these circumstances are based on that covenant relationship, right? This sense that we have agreed that God is our God, that he will stop at nothing to pursue us, to rescue us, to deliver us, even though that might not look exactly like what we want it to in the moment. And third, this is going to sound really silly. You are a real person with real life circumstances. You are experiencing things that are very much in your mind. You maybe even have people around you saying things, speaking things into your circumstances that may not always feel great. Sort of like that guy David. But you also have a covenant relationship with God. It's available to you if you haven't seized it yet, if you haven't walked into that relationship with yet, it's available to you. And if you have, please, when you are reading the Psalms, but when you are reading your own life, when you are experiencing things, please, please remember this. From the Lord comes deliverance. He is a shield around you on all sides. He is the one that lifts your head. He is the one that speaks truth over you, though there are lies everywhere. These are the takeaways. So we're going to give you a couple of minutes to dwell on that. And Jeremy, if you can come up and give us a little mood music, right, to help us think, to help center us. Here's what we kind of want you to work through, and I apologize, I didn't put these up on the wall, so you're going to have to remember what I'm saying, so I'm going to say them a few times. The first thing we want you to ask yourself is, what are the circumstances that you're in, that you're going through? Maybe they're not as dark and as desperate as David's. I hope to God they are not. Maybe they're actually joyous and joyful, but everywhere in between, there is life. And so what is it? What's going on in your life? Become aware of your circumstances. And next, as you kind of begin to identify that, we want you to ask yourself, what are you feeling? What are the emotions? What are the thoughts that your mind and your heart are using to describe what's going on inside of you? And I said that on purpose that way, right? Because sometimes if we ever dare get the chance to be quiet and reflective, we're not always in control of what's coming up and what's coming out. Spend some time here over these next few minutes. What are your circumstances? What are you feeling? And then how are you responding, or how will you respond to this based on how God is revealing himself to you? What's going on? What's going on in you because of what's going on? And how will you respond based on the covenant relationship that you have? God's revelation of himself to you in the midst of your circumstances. So we're just going to take a few minutes. Jeremy, go ahead. Let me pray as we get started. God, we don't often think this way. To be honest with you, sometimes it's super irritating to be reflective. But we're struck, God, in this moment by the sense that if we're ever going to know you to love you, if we're ever going to know ourselves to love ourselves, these commands that you've given us that lead into all the other avenues of life, that we need to do this. So God, we confess that we're no good at it. We confess that maybe we're afraid or anxious about it. But you are a covenant God. And when we cry out to you, you answer. From the place of all authority and all power, you come. God, convince us of that today more than ever. And God, in the power of your Spirit, guide our thoughts, guide our awareness of our own selves, and guide us in awareness of how you're revealing yourself to us now. Jesus, we give you these moments of silent reflection as a way to honor you and what you want to do in our lives, and as a way to love ourselves. So take them now in the name of Jesus.